Next, we have John Turner, who's going to talk about the hydrogen economy. And you got it.
Thank you. Okay, so I'm going to zoom through a little discussion on the hydrogen economy and how it impacts all kinds of things. Okay, I think we all know that, but it doesn't hurt to reinforce it all the time. Energy is important to modern society as food and water. We all talk about food and water, but nothing happens without energy these days. Securing our energy future is critical. Money and energy we can conserve, but time lost is gone forever. And you know, having to do 500 plants, 1 gigawatt plants a year, we're losing time. This is from one of the secretaries of India. Energy is the major input for overall social economic development. If we want the population growth to level off or come down, we have to add energy. There's just no question about it. But I think that was a point well taken. The other thing that sometimes is missed in all of this is, every country wants to be secure. And national security depends on energy security. So that's very, very important if we want to provide other countries with a feeling of security. lots of solar energy, and so that's what I'm mainly going to be using sort of as my energy source on these sort of things. The question was, how much energy would it take to power? How much land area would you have to cover? This is a calculation. It was in Science in '99, so a long time ago. But if you wanted to power all the electricity needs, and this is use, not demand, because you have losses in the line. So this is actually what is used in the calculation. So back in '99, I said a 10% system efficiency and 50% coverage. The system efficiencies now are approaching 20%, probably about 18. So that, of course, has to do with area. That lowers the amount of area. You probably can't do a 50% coverage. That's a little tight. But at that time, this square was 10,000 square miles. That's 100 miles on a side. And that would provide, in terms of kilowatt hours, the same number of kilowatt hours as we now have. And that doesn't include energy storage and all that. But so we have lots of area. We're one of the largest users of energy. If we can do this, you can put these little things all over the place, and you can see that. This is just with solar. You throw in hydro, throw in wind, we're doing a lot of stuff in wave and other things, so that gets smaller and smaller. So it's eminently doable. The question is, how do we go about it? Photovoltaics, again, because the solar is our greatest resource. You can look at prices of modules and whatnot. And this last one over here, they talk about grid parity. And the idea is that the electricity, if you calculate over the lifetime of a solar panel, the price per kilowatt hour is the same as what we pay in the plug wall, and they call that grid parity. And today, solar is about equal to that, but I have a little caveat all the time. It looks like grid parity, but it's misleading because the cost of electricity, the module is in sunlight and operating, it doesn't include any energy storage, which will triple that number. So that's something we have to worry about, figure out, because sun doesn't shine all the time. So, energy storage and our transportation fuel. We can supply all our electrical needs pretty straightforwardly, but we have other needs. So we need an energy carrier. And my definition of energy carrier, energy stored in chemical bonds, basically a fuel like gasoline. So gasoline's an energy carrier, coal's an energy carrier, natural gas, all these elements, and hydrogen, carry energy and chemical bonds, which we break and burn and make CO2 and water, and that's where we get our energy, and we turn that into shaft power and whatever, so that we can do our things. So what I'm suggesting is that hydrogen can become that carbon-free. We have to have a carbon-free energy source, or at least a zero carbon, zero cycle carbon energy source. So here's hydrogen. People think it's hard to make, et cetera, et cetera. It's not. Worldwide, we make over 50 million metric tons per year of hydrogen. It's a $60 billion market. Most of it comes from fossil fuels, steam methane reforming, partial oxidation of old, gasification of coal, which really puts out a lot of CO2, and 4% of electrolysis. I'll come back to a little bit later. Uses, half of it's used approximately in hydroforming, hydrocracking, taking this high sulfur oil and turning it into gasoline. The other half's used for ammonia. And that is incredibly important because it's the Haber-Bosch process, which is what he used to make this ammonia, is considered one of the greatest inventions of our lifetime. That ammonia helps feed three billion extra people on our planet because of the increased crop production. And as the planet grows to 9 billion, we're going to need even more ammonia and better crop production to feed that kind of people. So people talk about, speak against hydrogen for transportation and other things. They forget you don't eat if you don't have hydrogen to make ammonia. And there's even some talk about using ammonia as an energy carrier. You know, it's probably going to be food first if you're going to make ammonia. So, but anyway, very, very important. If we want to go to sort of carbon neutral materials, we can use biomass as a feedstock. So biomass pulls the CO2 out of the air and we burn it. Okay, so that's where we were for the last, 50,000 years or so. We burned a tree and another tree grew. It was all basically zero. The problem is that the oils and whatnot you get from biomass have more heteroatoms that are harder to refine. So if you look up here for hydrotreating, hydrocracking, it's anywhere from 6 kilograms of hydrogen per barrel down to 0.2. If we want to turn biomass of some sort into gasoline, it takes anywhere from 4 to 15 kilograms of hydrogen. So the amount of hydrogen that we're going to need for that sort of thing will even go up. And recognize, airplanes don't run on batteries. For those of you that flew, you had to have a nice hydrocarbon fuel. And that's going to continue. We're going to have to unless we have some great breakthrough, airplanes we'll have to use. Food, of course, is stored solar energy. A lot of people don't actually associate it with that, but food is energy stored in chemical bonds, and we breathe in and out and burn it. So that leads to my sustainable hydrogen economy, production of hydrogen primarily from water, but also from other feedstocks, distribution and utilization as an energy carrier and chemical feedstock. So there's the hydrogen economy. And this was actually first discussed as the hydrogen economy occurred back in the 70s. The nuclear power industry was going to make all this hydrogen and supplant gasoline, et cetera. Of course, it hasn't happened yet, but sooner or later. So the energy generation and feedstock must be sustainable. Now, my definition of sustainable is an energy system that'll last for millennia. The current one will probably run out, 300 years, 400 years or so. But we want something, if we're going to replace it, and it's a $1 trillion infrastructure, we've got to put $1 trillion, just make sure it lasts. So you have your energy generation, which I think you mainly had production of hydrogen from various feedstocks, water and biomass. Distribution and utilization. All these things exist now. all of them. We used the distribution things already used for current hydrogen production. We can do electrolysis, we can do all that. Fuel cell cars are starting to be on the road, turbines, ice engines. Of course, we use it in ammonia production. So all the pieces of this particular concept are there. So here's our sustainable path to hydrogen, how you get hydrogen sustainably. Well, obviously you start with solar energy and then you can use that energy and do an energy conversion. So you can take heat and break water apart. Mechanical energy, which is wind or electricity, or solar, which makes electricity, that'll give you, you can use an electrolysis. I'll talk about that. biomass, and then there's this interesting area of photolysis. And notice the bottom here. Everybody talks about technology, but at the end of the day, the final cost of hydrogen will determine the pathway. It's economics. Somehow we have to drive the economics, either with tax incentives, something or other. We have to drive the economics, because that's the only way this is going to work. So electrolyzers are very simple devices, two metal electrodes in an aqueous solution, water solution. You apply a small voltage, a couple volts, and voila, water falls apart into hydrogen and oxygen. And of course, you can drive that with any kind of electricity generating device. So an electrolyzer is an energy conversion device. It converts electrical energy into chemical energy in the form of chemical bonds, which is what an energy carrier is. There are all these stories that electrolysis is too hard to do. Not so. Electrolysis has been commercial since the 20s, but actually really commercial since the 40s. So these big electrolyzer plants have been running for many, many years. This was one in Norway. It's connected to a hydroelectric plant, generating 70,000 kilograms of hydrogen per day. It ran from 1948 to 1990. Of course, in 1990, about that area is where natural gas in the North Sea showed up, and turns out steam methane reforming is cheaper or easier. So that's why this thing shut down. But there's still a plant running, a number of plants around the world running, and this was hydrogen for ammonia. So they use this hydrogen and they still use that same area, but now they just get their hydrogen from other places. I want to just briefly mention, because I want to sort of sensitize you all to something that's been going on in the literature about hydrogen and about electrolysis. Because I think electrolysis, if we move forward for ammonia production and everything else that we need, we're going to have to make hydrogen, there's no question. To make hydrocarbons, you've got to have hydrogen. It'll all come from electrolysis, or most of it will come from electrolysis, because we'll have electricity. Alkaline electrolyzers, oldest technology since 1926. They're the largest size. They use very strong caustic, 20% KOH, 25% KOH. And they run from anywhere continuously, like from 60 to 80,000 hours continuously. So they're a pretty reliable system. They use nickel. So they have two nickel plates with a separator, and they put the voltage between those nickel plates, and they split water that way. The more expensive ones are what they call proton exchange membrane fuel cells. These are the fuel cells that show up in cars. So you hear about the Mirai and these other fuel cell vehicles that that the automotive manufacturers are putting out. They're using technology similar to this, where it's a solid piece of plastic, and they have precious metal catalysts, platinum, in this particular case, iridium. So there's an issue right there, because there's a finite amount. Now, people talk about how little platinum there is and all that, and we won't be able to do this sort of thing. People forget all our cars have anywhere from 1 to 3 grams of precious metals in them. And we have like 850 million cars with catalytic converters in them. So just because something's scarce doesn't mean it's not scalable. And so the issue is here, if we have to use precious metals, can we keep it down to a level where it is scalable? I think that's still an open question on these things. I think on the fuel cell side, for the cars, they can probably just use about the same amount as using a catalytic converter, in which case one can see that that would be sustainable. So I want to talk about something that's been going on in the literature for a while that bugs the hell out of me, along with other things. But people talk about these precious metals like, it's a showstopper, number one. Number two, they do experiments and get these great publications. Now, this is a publication in Nature, which is what most scientists would like to have, is a great publication in Nature. And they basically do it fraudulently. And by the way, I get up in front of large crowds and say this, and people who write these papers. So you get a thing like iridium oxide, ruthenium oxide are the benchmark catalysts for oxygen evolution. And so we need to find an alternative for that, right? And so what they do is then they take their process, then they take their experiments, and they say, well, we have a nickel, iron electrode, and nickel, which works just as well. Now, here the problem is, I told you there's two kinds of electrolyzers. One is the alkaline electrolyzer, which uses nickel plates to start with and has the 20s. The other is this new PEM electrolyzer, which uses the precious metals. It's an acid-based system, okay? So what they do is they do a little bait and switch. They present a straw man, precious metals and electrolysis. This is relevant because then they do their experiments in the conditions where only non-precious metals are used. So they have this wonderful thing that say their catalysts are better than the acid, than the precious metals, but their catalysts would never be stable where the precious metals are used. It's kind of like saying, you know, my Ferrari's better than your boat. Well, let's stick my Ferrari in the middle of a lake and just see how well it works. Their catalysts wouldn't be stable under these things. And this is, the reason I point this out is because you get, we talk, you know, science by publication. You get publications like this where it says, unlike other water electrolyzers that use precious metals, the area they worked in already does not use precious metals. This should never have been published. If they'd sent this to me, it would have got blown up. And I write the editors and explain to them that this isn't the proper way to do things. And just point out, electrolysis produces 2 million metric tons of hydrogen per year already. So it's not a technology that we can't do. The main cost for hydrogen is not the precious metals, it's not the system, capital costs have something to do with it. The main deterring factor for the cost of hydrogen is the price of electricity. As the price of electricity goes down, the cost of hydrogen goes down. Now, current steam methane reforming puts out hydrogen at about between $2 and $3 a kilogram. And as you can see, if you get electricity prices down to 20 cents a kilowatt hour, 2 cents a kilowatt hour, you're starting to get hydrogen in that area. So I think it's pretty clear we can make hydrogen competitively this way. We just have to start building plants, and that's so there's the situation. Look at Mexico City. This technology, if you look at how are we going to fuel something like that with renewable energy? And so I had this little proposal. These are all modular systems, so you could actually put an electrolyzer and fuel cell in your house. And at some point, the cost will come down where you actually can do that. And then little communities can act as, hydrogen can be their energy storage system, and they can tie their systems together kind of like a series of computers. We can store hydrogen large scale. People don't know we already store hydrogen in very large volumes. This is a storage system in Louisiana. We have these salt domes, which is where hydrogen is stored now. You think it might leak. It doesn't. And so it's very doable. I just briefly mention the stuff that I do, which is basically taking a solar cell and electrolyzer and combining it into a single device. It's called photoelectrochemistry, thus the PEC. And it works. It's basic research, benchtop stuff. It might lower the cost of hydrogen if we can make it work. So I want to close. Lessons from an ancient text. So I was part of a National Academy group where we got together with some Iranian scientists who came to California, and they were always talking about the Quran and what was in the Quran and how that worked on their science. So I put together a little something of letting them know that there's a more ancient text that also has stuff important to it. The first one, he causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good, which in my interpretation, solar energy is free and for everyone. Okay? Hey, you know. The next one, the sun rises and the sun sets, then hurries around to rise again. My interpretation of that, solar energy is intermittent. Okay, so we have to deal with that. The wise store up choice food and olive oil, but fools gulp theirs down. My interpretation, the wise will store energy and have light and warmth at night, but fools will gulp their energy and will freeze in the dark. So, that's my presentation. Okay, yep.
I'm just curious, is there global warming potential for hydrogen?
If it's made from solar energy, if it's made from carbon-free electricity sources, no.
No, but I mean, if, you know, if we had 1,000 ppm of hydrogen in the...
It doesn't get that high. It's chewed up in the area. There's lots of bugs that chew it up. If you release hydrogen, it goes up, it'll combine the ozone layer. So it's not a global warming. It won't last in there much at all.
Yeah, kill
you,
that.
Yeah. Do you want to show another slide?
Uh-huh. And there's his. Okay. No, yes.
Could you comment on two technologies that are available today, namely the future of fuel cell powered electric cars, mm-hmm. and also getting electricity from natural gas using fuel cells?
So two things. Fuel cell cars are on the road. The problem is we don't have hydrogen filling stations, right? We have one in Denver over here. But there are building hydrogen filling stations.
So you can
get gasoline filling stations here in downtown. Cars first start coming out. So we know about this kind of transition. There's going to be, I think, two paths. One is the pure electric, the battery. But when you start to go to trucks and bigger vehicles, the battery system just adds too much weight. And the fuel cells are much lighter and a better choice. And so, yeah, there's cars on the road. We have four of them in NREL that we use and run around. They work fine. The issue will be getting the production up, cost down. The automotives wouldn't put them out if they didn't think they could get the cost down. And they're very good at getting costs. Your second thing about making electricity from natural gas using fuel cells, yes. Solid oxide fuel cells and molten carbonate fuel cells can burn those fuels directly and make electricity with very high efficiency. But the combined cycle natural gas plants are also just as efficient. And they're, you know, you can build those very, very easily. So I don't know that there's, in my view, there's not really a lot of reason to burn natural gas through a fuel cell and make electricity. Now, in Japan, they have small, what they call reformers, that make hydrogen, and people use that to heat their homes. So that might be an alternative. But the combined cycle is for burning fossil fuels, if you're going to burn fossil fuels. Okay?
All right. Thank you. John?